welcome to episode 2 of the Nats GM Show, the exclusive podcast from the Nats GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com. This week's guest on the Nats GM Show is Dr. Dan Brooks, a neurobiologist at Tufts University. Dan is well-known in baseball circles as the creator of BrooksBaseball.net, the data scientist and author at Baseball Prospectus, and a founder of Saber Seminar, an annual conference in Boston that combines sabermetrics, scouting, science, and cancer research. He also happens to be the first doctor I've ever interviewed. Dan, welcome to the Nats GM Show.
Thanks so much, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for sharing a few minutes of your time with us today.
Sure, of course.
First topic I want to kind of just bring up to you is Saber Seminar in general. I was fortunate enough to meet you there last summer at the event, truly one of the best events I've ever experienced in baseball, and I was hoping you could give everybody an introduction to what it is and just discuss it briefly.
Sure. So Saber Seminar, or the more formal name, which is Sabermetrics, Scouting, and the Science of Baseball, is it's in its fourth year now. It's a charity event for the Jimmy Fund. And, you know, we bring together people like GMs and coaches and baseball researchers and former baseball players and things like that that come and give panel discussions and, you know, sort of tell stories about their time in baseball. And, I think it's now essentially one of the premier baseball research events in the country, at least in terms of, you know, the kinds of speakers that we have and the new research that's presented. It's sort of modeled after an academic style conference. So, you know, it's a little bit more laid back and less formal than, you know, some of the other big, more corporate sponsored events. It's a bit cheaper than those, and every ticket goes to the Jimmy Fund, which is a Boston area cancer research charity. And this year, you know, we're sponsored by a whole bunch of teams, the Mets and Royals and Red Sox and Orioles and Nationals. And there's one I'm forgetting. I'm such a bad person. Well, I'll pick that up later.
They'll forget you.
Yeah, probably. But it's a fantastic fun weekend of baseball nerdery and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, I can certainly vouch for that. How did the idea come about in the first place?
Actually, you know, the event sort of grew out. So the co-organizer, and really the brains behind the organization in some ways, is Chuck Korb, who I know through a Red Sox website. You know, so we've been friends for a while. He actually taught a high school summer class. His real love is sort of teaching and working with kids and stuff. And he started a high school summer class at MIT some number of years ago that was sort of about the science of baseball. And maybe 4 years ago, we thought, you know, it would be a cool thing to bring into, you know, a bigger, more sort of professional, real-life, not high school student audience. And so he started it, and the first one was at Harvard 4 years ago. And then we moved to BU, we grew a little bit, and it sort of took off from there.
Yeah, I can vouch for it. I think it's the best baseball experience I've ever had, not in a park. So
That is very high praise.
Yeah, so it's a tremendous event. I think tickets are all sold out, so we don't really need to plug it for this year, but maybe for next year?
Yeah, sadly, it's sold out. It's sold out quicker and quicker every year, which means either we need to find a bigger space or raise the price, and I hope we're going to lean towards just buying a bigger space.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are events that charge $500 for a ticket, and it's just, it's hard for me to justify. You know, it's supposed to be a bunch of friends getting together, talking about baseball, and, you know, meeting cool people in the process. You know, it's not supposed to break the bank. And again, it's all sort of charity. So it's I think it's in a good place right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think 100% of the proceeds go to the Jimmy Fund.
Uh-huh.
So that's truly amazing. So I don't know how to transition off of Saber Seminar, but I do want to talk to you, as I mentioned at the top, about Brooks Baseball and PitchFX a little bit. My audience may not be really aware of what PitchFX even is to a certain degree. They probably understand it just in their baseball knowledge, but they don't know what it is. Can you explain it a little bit?
Sure. So PitchFX is a technology that was developed by Sport Vision, which is a technology broadcast company, and MLBAM, which is the sort of technology arm of baseball. And essentially what PitchFX is are two cameras, one placed in the field somewhere, not on the actual field. They don't like interrupt the game, but you know, in the ballpark somewhere. And they sort of capture pictures of the ball on its way to home plate. And then because we play baseball on Earth and we have a pretty good idea of how things move on Earth through air, you can create sort of a model trajectory of every pitch. And it with actually a small, pretty small number of parameters, right? So you remember from high school physics class, you know, Joey throws a rock at 30 degrees, you know, off the ground, and, you know, he throws it 45 miles an hour, you know, where does it land or whatever?
Sure.
And you know, your physics teacher would, you know, draw a little arc, and you'd have to calculate where it was. It turns out you can do pretty similar things. There's a few complications because typically in high school physics you weren't including the effects of air drag or whatever else. You can do pretty similar things with a baseball. And so what PitchFX is it's sort of a system for doing that for every pitch in the major league. And this lets us extract a whole bunch of really interesting things about what pitchers do when they throw the ball.
Well, that's a perfect, almost leads into my next question. What can we learn or what information can be derived from this type of, you know, information that we're gathering or you're gathering?
Almost anything that you would want to know about the flight of the baseball or what happens afterwards. We can, for example, tell apart, you know, four-seam fastballs and two-seam fastballs and how much individual curves drop and, you know, how fast the ball is spinning and, you know, where in the zone a particular pitcher is locating it, or, you know, we can learn things about hitters, like, you know, where does this guy tend to drive the ball for power, you know, in terms of, like, where in the strike zone he gets pitched, or, you know, is a particular pitcher using a particular kind of pitch on 0-2 more than he's using on, you know, a 1-1 count. So we can learn a ton of information. It's sort of like an interface between what you would traditionally think of as being baseball statistics and what you would traditionally think of as baseball scouting.
Now, we've seen it used a little bit recently, or at least people and teams are trying to use it to, I guess, diagnose injuries or see when they've occurred. I know Jose Fernandez immediately jumps to mind. Is that kind of the next frontier for PitchFX?
What, injury prevention?
Injury prevention or identification or things along that line.
Well, so the yes and no, right? So I think that in injuries, certainly PitchFX can help the data that we get from PitchFX can certainly help us as outsiders look at a particular pitcher and say, you know, maybe there's something wrong. Or if you are a team that might be looking to acquire a particular player, maybe you could, you know, use this kind of data to get a different sort of view. But the truth is that teams have medical records and they have doctors and they can just, you know, if you think Jose Fernandez's elbow is hurting him, either you can spend 4 hours pouring through PitchFX data, or, you know, if you're the Marlins, you just go to Jose Fernandez and you say, is your elbow hurting you?
Right,
and
sure.
So, there's a certain degree to which data helps inform decisions that can't be answered in easier ways. And I personally do not have a direct line to Jose Fernandez, so I can't ask him, you know, hey, does your elbow hurt? But, you know, the Marlins have 12 different ways to ask Jose Fernandez if his elbow hurts, probably in multiple languages. And so, you know, I think that people outside the game, and I'm certainly not accusing you of anything, I'm just saying outside the game, I think we tend to complicate problems in ways, you know, like, why isn't so-and-so pitching the eighth? He's clearly a better pitcher. You know, what is the manager doing? Is he an idiot? Blah, blah, blah.
Of course.
How could this be true? And, you know, you just don't know that whoever it is has stomach problems today. You know, and so, you know, it's like nobody files the stomach problems report. And so you don't know that information. But if you did know that information, maybe you wouldn't think that whoever your manager is such a big idiot.
Right.
And, you know, I think that we tend to do that a little bit with pitch effects data in the sense that, you know, we look at it and we say, well, why isn't he throwing his slider or whatever, or why is he, you know, locating the pitch there? And it's like, well, you know, maybe there are extenuating circumstances that, you know, explain these things. And, you know, with some simple inside knowledge, we could get more information.
Right. Sometimes the easiest answer is the actual answer.
Sure.
So with pitch effects, we've talked a lot about the pitching side of it. What can we learn, or what can, you know, people who know what they're looking at with this data, what can we learn about from the hitting side?
You know, I think we can learn a lot, although, you know, in some ways, hitting is a reactionary thing. You know, you come up to the plate, and whereas you're the pitcher, you get to decide what you're going to do. The hitter also gets decisions, but they're sort of all related to, you know, what the pitchers have decided to do first. And so, you know, not only, so we get to know some interesting things, like, are pitchers pitching, you know, Miguel Cabrera a little bit differently this year than they were last year? We get to know interesting things like, you know, if you look at Dustin Pedroia's, you know, power over different parts of the strike zone, has that changed over the course of his career? We get to know things like, you know, given Marco Scudero's ridiculously low swing rate, how does he actually discriminate the strike zone? You know, so we can learn stuff like that. You know, but again, it's all sort of predicated upon the idea that the first actor, whoever it is, the pitcher, is going to make some decision before the batter gets to make the decision, you know, that he wants.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's such a simple concept, but I've never thought of it that way. The whole thing starts with the pitcher and throwing the baseball. You can't learn anything until the, you know, pitcher throws the ball, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, Russell Carlton, who writes at BP, you know, there's various stats that stabilize over different amounts of time, right? And, you know, so like batting average stabilizes actually at a ridiculously long rate. You know, so it's like 900 plate appearances or something. This is a ridiculously long number. You tend to think of batting average as stabilizing very quickly. Instead, it takes a very long time. But, you know, like there's fielding statistics, and there's pitching statistics, and they stabilize at different rates. And a good proxy for thinking about how long something takes to stabilize is, you know, how many decisions intervene before that player gets the ball, or how many bounces the ball takes before that player gets the ball. You know, so the more and more and more decisions or bounces the ball takes, the more noise gets added, and it takes longer for something to stabilize. So we know pretty quickly how fast a guy throws his fastball, or where he's going to locate his curve, or whatever, but it takes a little bit more time before hitting statistics stabilize, just because those are all predicated on the fact that those guys face lots of individual pitchers who all decide things before they do.
That's really fascinating. I hadn't thought of it that way. I don't know how to, once again, I don't know how to transition off this, but a topic that I love to ask guests on the show is, with the rash of injuries to the elbows of pitchers, particularly young, hard-throwing pitchers in the majors recently, I just kind of want to get your take on Do you think it's a small sample size? Do you think there's a reason for it or reasons for it? Or just kind of your thoughts on the whole epidemic, if that's the right word.
So I don't think it's a small sample size thing. I think clearly elbows get hurt, and they're getting hurt at a faster rate now than they were before. I think that for the most part, I mean, there's other parts that get hurt, right? Shoulders get hurt and things like that.
Sure, of course.
I think, you know, the sort of sad truth is that throwing the ball hard is a really, really, really beneficial thing if you're a pitcher. You know, so you want to throw the ball hard. And unfortunately, throwing the ball hard leads to elbow injuries. Putting more and more and more stress on your arm is never good. And the way the sport is currently constructed is the guys who put more stress on their arms see the best performing. There are certainly exceptions to that, but that's just, you know, I mean, when you're graded as by a scout on your fastball, you know, more or less, I understand that there are nuances, but more or less it's correlated with your velocity, you know, and that predicts success, right? Everybody wants an 80 fastball, the other problem is that the sort of risk structure in the sport, the way the sport is constructed is basically everybody wants you to put that elbow under as much strain as possible. So nobody wants you to blow your elbow out or blow your arm out or whatever, but they sort of do, right? They want you to strike people out, and, you know, you want to strike people out, and, you know, you want to be successful. And so all the factors that sort of cause pitcher arm injuries are the same factors that predict success.
Yeah, I mean, you almost set yourself up for the injury.
So. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a very, you know, the other thing is that, you know, as a prospect, one of the best ways to get noticed is to be somebody who throws the ball the hardest.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's really the best thing for you as a person in the future, I don't know. But it certainly doesn't seem to be a good idea to, you know, I mean, it seems to be a good idea if you want to get drafted. I don't know if it seems to be a good idea if you want to keep your arm healthy. Although certainly this is not my area of expertise. You know, this just is sort of my general understanding is, you know, I mean, there's a thing that breaks, and the quote from Glenn Fleissig actually last year at Sabre Seminar was relatively instructive here, where he was like, you know, they do these tests on cadavers, so obviously these are not healthy 25-year-old, you know, stud athletes. These are cadavers.
Yeah, slightly different thing.
Which it seems as though the Red Sox have been using pitch most of the season, but but the truth is that they do these tests, and it's sort of like any time you put the UCL under the kind of strain that would be expected from almost any major league pitch, it breaks. And so you can almost consider that every time, there's a sort of school of thought, which is like, UCL injuries are rare and you can throw and whatever else, but almost the flip side is true, which is that all the people you see throwing baseballs are sort of at the far, far, far end of the normal distribution, which is like, on the tail of the distribution, is like people who have thrown pitches and survived.
Yeah, I mean, they're so far off the bell curve, it's, you know, incredible. So,
yeah.
Well, I don't know. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, so, you know, I mean, these are people who just sort of, they're sort of lucky in that they haven't had their elbows break yet. You know, so.
That's a good point. I'd be remiss if I didn't, while I had you on the broadcast, if I didn't ask you a little bit about Masahiro Tanaka and just the monster dominating performance he's putting up so far in 2014. Just what are you seeing from him?
Well, Tanaka's pretty good.
I was trying to lob that up for you a little bit, yeah.
No, Tanaka's good at throwing baseballs. I think the interesting thing about Tanaka is not how good he's been, because, we could spend a lot of time talking about how good he's been. But I think the interesting thing is how unpredictably good he's been, not in the sense that people didn't think he would be good, but I don't know if people thought he would be this good.
Correct.
If you look, there are some really interesting articles. They're appeared on a variety of places, but BP has one last year where it's, I'm not sure exactly whose byline it's under. It might be Jason. It might actually be a Kevin Goldstein article asking what scouts are saying about Tanaka, where he sort of interviewed a whole bunch of people and asked them, would you take X player over Tanaka?
I remember this story. It was terrific. Yeah, it was on BP.
Yeah, and, I think people sort of thought that Tanaka had, a 2 ceiling, but would probably be, a 3, or maybe a little bit less than that.
Exactly, right.
And, so I don't think anybody looked at this guy and was like, oh, this guy's going to be an ace. Okay, so knowing now that you know that he can put up a month and a half of being basically an ace, right? I mean, he's been very, very good.
Yeah, maybe the best pitcher in baseball.
I don't know whether or not I totally changed my opinion about him in the sense that, look, all the stats are there. Everything says he's very, very good. Imagine that Troy Tulowitzki was actually not a major league player before this season and was actually a prospect in Japan. And he came over, he was signed by the Rockies, and now suddenly he's the best hitter in baseball. He was supposed to be good, but he wasn't supposed to be the best hitter in baseball. And now you ask yourself, is Troy Tulowitzki for the next 4 years going to be the best hitter in baseball? Right?
Right,
and,
sure.
And I think that's sort of what we're doing with Tanaka, right? I mean, these are people who had seen him repeatedly for years before they were interviewed by Kevin or Jason. I can't remember which. I'm sorry, Kevin or Jason. Or it might have been Ben. I don't know. Somebody, right? And they are people with expert opinions, the people that were interviewed. And they made decisions. Do you want Tanaka or somebody else? And sort of slotted him as a number 3 starter. Now that you've seen a month of being one of the best pitchers in baseball, do you suddenly say, oh, I totally need to reevaluate all my opinions about Tanaka? Or do you say, Clay Buchholz was the best pitcher in baseball for 2 months of last season?
Yeah, that's a great call.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a great call, yeah.
Does anybody think that Clay Buchholz is going to be the best pitcher in the American League for the next 4 years? Mm-hmm. I don't know that we would get anyone to agree to that, but if you had chosen, now obviously he sort of got hurt, or he caught the Hellenic flu, or whatever kind of, excuse he's coming up with these days, for not being able to throw the ball anywhere but the middle of the plate, so the point is that I think Tanaka is an interesting case for how we should evaluate players in, it's not a small sample size, but it's pretty small relative to what we would consider to be a large sample size. So,
Yeah, I mean, I guess anyway. The only thing we can say at this point is his ceiling is probably higher than we expected. That's probably what we've learned.
Yes, but I think that we could go through a whole bunch of people's careers and find a month and a half of dominance. And the question is this really Tanaka, or is this the best Tanaka?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Tim Wakefield had stretches where he would put up an 0-30 ERA with tons of strikeouts. You know, that he would look like the best pitcher in baseball. And it's like, did he figure anything out? No, it's just like, he was really good for a month and a half. He was still, like, sort of just a guy. And I apologize for my Red Sox bias. You know, growing up in Boston, it's a very availability, heuristic-driven thing, coming up with names. And anytime I try and come up with a replacement-level player right now, I'm like, oh, Grady Sizemore. It's like, nobody else should have seen Grady Sizemore all year. You know, like, why have you looked at Grady Sizemore? And yet, you know, if you're a Red Sox fan, you know what replacement level looks like right now.
Well, I call myself the Nats GM show, so I kind of go with the Nationals as well, so I can definitely understand.
I apologize. Well, before I come on next, I will go through and I will study for replacement level Nationals players. See, that's the problem with replacement level guys, is it's like, not only can you not think of them off the top of your head,
The one name,
like,
that jumped out.
No reason you would know about them. You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the one name that jumped out to me was Mike Fieri for the Brewers a couple years ago. All of a sudden was pitching great, and then next thing you knew, he was kind of off the radar.
Yeah, well, you know, so I don't think Tanaka's going to drop off the radar. Tanaka's
sure.
a very good pitcher. It's just, the point is it's like, you know, it's like, given a month and a half of dominance, what do you think someone's next X years are going to be like? Because that's sort of what you're asking. Right? I mean, like,
yeah, precisely.
If you're asking, was Tanaka good? The answer is yes, Tanaka was good. If you're asking, is Tanaka going to continue to be good? Then you're asking a different question. And I think a question that's, you know, I mean, it's partially going to be driven by what he's done so far in the big leagues, which is be really good. But it's also going to be driven by what people thought he was going to do in the big leagues, you know?
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm sorry I've taken up so much of your time, but there is one more question I want to ask you. Like I said, you know, obviously I'm Nats GM. I focus on the Nationals a great deal. What is somebody from the Boston area and a little bit of an outsider's perspective, so to speak, your opinion on the evolution of Steven Strasburg as a pitcher?
That's a good question. So, so let's see, a couple of years ago, Steven Strasburg was like one of the appointment viewing pitchers in baseball, sort of like Tanaka is appointment viewing, like Darvish is appointment viewing, like Kershaw, you know what I mean? Like,
absolutely,
he's somebody,
yes.
You sort of look at the list of games, and you're like, oh, I'm going to keep this one on because this is the game I want to see. And actually, at the start of this year, like, maybe he got a little bit, like, that slider was crazy, and maybe he got a little bit of that back. You know, he looks like he's sort of, so the problem with power pitchers is that, you know, from basically the first month of their career on, they're in decline. You know what I mean? Like, they're a little bit different than power hitters, you know? So, like, I think Bryce Harper has legit shot in 4 years to be the, you know, the best, one of the best power hitters in baseball.
Yeah,
you know,
that's funny. I mean, the hitters kind of age like red wine, and the pitchers age like white wine.
I actually know nothing about wine, but I will accept your. I know. You know, you want to age red wine. Do you not age white wine? I don't know anything about it.
That's what my dad tells me. He's a wine guy. I don't know either. I stick to cheap beer,
right, so
you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a good point. I hadn't thought about it like that. Again, I know nothing about wine, but I will say that, you know, if you look at Strasburg's stuff over the course of his career, it's sort of gotten worse. But he's I think grown as a pitcher. He's been very good. He had a very dominant outing last time. He did actually. Right, he flirted with a slider and scrapped it at the beginning of this year. I think he's going to go through, that sort of first change as a pitcher when you start losing, you know, a couple of years ago, Strasburg was sort of routinely pumping in 100 mile an hour fastballs.
Right.
I don't think he's touched 100 this year, which is kind of an interesting thought, right?
I mean, that's quite a jump. Yeah, absolutely. Or drop, I should say.
He's been at 98, he's been at 99. According to our numbers, which are sort of part corrected and reclassified, I don't think he's thrown a 100-mile-an-hour fastball this year. I could be wrong. I can go double check that. Or at least, you know, it's not in the sort of confidence interval. But the point is that, you know, so as a power pitcher, you know, they never get their arms never get better, really. And so, you know, I think that once he, you know, if you're throwing 95, it doesn't really, you know, there's not too much difference. But there is a little bit of a difference in terms of, you know, my perception of him in terms of, you know, is he the guy I want to watch? You know, and so I don't know exactly what I'm saying, only that it's sort of interesting from an outsider perspective, the whole, you know, should we keep him healthy, should we not keep him healthy kind of thing from a couple of years ago was one of those things where it's like, you're not really choosing between keeping a guy the same and potentially damaging him. Like, any time goes on, he gets worse, you know? So there's a little bit of a, you know, I don't know that was so clear to everybody, certainly not to me, maybe, in the debate of a couple years past.
Yeah, that's actually a terrific point. The only thing that I would say is just watching Strasburg is his changeup has gotten, I don't know if it's better, but it's gotten more consistent in the last, it feels like, you know, this season anyways.
He does have a ridiculous changeup.
And he's throwing it now for strikes and really putting it in the zone as well, not just burying it for swings and misses like, you know, you've talked about, I think, at Sabre Seminar last year, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he does have one of the most, like, whiffy changeups in the game. But if he's, it's gone down slightly again over the course of his career. But if he's able to throw that pitch and keep it consistent, I mean, you know, he's going to continue to be a very good pitcher for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Dan, for joining me. It was really great. Thank you so much for giving me so much time. I'd love to give you a spot here just to, you know, plug Sabre Seminar, Twitter, whatever you want to plug.
Sure. You can follow me at Brooks Baseball on Twitter, where you get, you know, I'd say about, you know, 25% mix of baseball statistics, really lame humor. What else do you get 25% of?
Little snark.
Random comments about baseball at like 2 a.m. and updates to the website that nobody else sees. Sabre Seminar is fantastic. You should come, although the tickets are sold out this year. You should come next year. It'll be a great event again.
Well, I can't wait to see you in a few weeks in August for Sabre Seminar.
Yeah, stop by, say hi, and we'll get a beer together.
I certainly will. That sounds like a great, great idea. Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate you taking so much time this afternoon to join me, and I look forward to you talking to you again in the future.
No problem. Talk to you later.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye.
And that was my conversation with Baseball Prospectus and Brooks Baseball's Dr. Dan Brooks. I want to publicly thank him again for being so gracious and generous with his time. Do yourself the favor and go follow him on Twitter. He's definitely a must-follow there, and you should definitely try to read his work at BP and throughout the internet. He's a true resource to baseball fans and a must-read for me, everything he does. So before we conclude this week, episode number 2, I want to thank my producer, the man-child, Josh Owens. Thanks for making the drive up to help me get this show to actually record. I appreciate it. The audience also thanks you.
It's my pleasure, man. My pleasure.
And we will return later this week. It looks like we are going to have a 2-show week. I look like we're going to have 2 guests, so I don't want to jinx it, so I don't want to announce it yet, but look for another episode Thursday or Friday this week from the Nats GM show. And with that, until later this week, we're out. Thank you for listening, and remember, in the game of life, hunt fastballs.